Good afternoon. My name is Joseph Huff. My registration number is 34384. I'm a public defender and I represent the defendant, Mr. Morano. I want to start off with an adage that everybody knows, and that is there are two sides to every story, and I think everybody agrees that the truth often lies somewhere in between. And juries, when they evaluate cases and come to conclusions as far as who's guilty of what, they often take that into account. Anyone who knows criminal law knows that juries often cobble together parts of the testimony. They may take part A and B from one witness, not believe C and D, take C and D from another witness. And in this case, that's all we were asking for the jury to be allowed to do. I'll refresh the court's memory very briefly with some of the crucial facts. As this court knows, this was somewhat of a road rage incident. The victim claims that my client cut him off from the roadway, prevented him from passing, then at some point pulled up beside him, rolled down his window, said an expletive, and displayed a gun. My client agrees with some of this. He said they were both in some sort of heated road rage incident. He claims, however, that the victim was tailgating him. He brake checked the victim, the gun fell onto the floor, he picked up the gun, it rolled off the seat, he held it up, put it in the glove compartment. He claims that he never intended or knowingly put the victims in fear of imminent serious bodily injury. Now, he was charged with menacing and he was convicted of menacing, and he admitted to some of this stuff. He admitted that he had a deadly weapon, for instance, and that's consistent with disorderly conduct, too, that you have a deadly weapon. He did not, however, agree that he knowingly placed or attempted to place the victims in fear of imminent serious bodily injury. The disorderly conduct charge, which we were trying to get the jury to be allowed to consider, contains a lot of what menacing does. And I didn't even know what disorderly conduct was until I got this case, and I've been a criminal lawyer for quite a while. When I looked at the elements, I thought to myself, this looks an awful lot like a lesser included menacing. And the reason for that is that there's the same mens rea, knowingly or recklessly, there's a deadly weapon involved, and it's in a manner calculated to cause alarm. Now, the court in this case found that assuming everything the defendant says is true, this wasn't in a public place, and I don't even think the Attorney General argues that an interstate is not a public place. It clearly is. But the judge also said that the defendant never admitted that he displayed the weapon with the intent to, with a calculation to alarm. And I agree, he never said that. But that's not the point here. You don't just take one piece of the evidence, one witness's statements, and say because he didn't say every single thing that fits with disorderly conduct, he doesn't get that. It's up to the jury to say, okay, we believe some of the defendant's testimony and we believe some of the victim's testimony, and those two things cobbled together clearly fit disorderly conduct. All that has to be here is a rational basis in the evidence to support a verdict acquitting the defendant of a greater offense and convicting him of a lesser one.
Was there any evidence, Mr. Huff, of the calculated to alarm?
I think what the victim said would be ample evidence. The victim testified he rolled down the window, displayed the gun, and said an expletive. Now, the jury could believe, contrary to menacing and consistent with what the defendant said, that in doing that act he didn't intend to cause fear of imminent serious bodily injury. However, he did display the gun in a manner calculated to alarm, and that's what's required.
Calculated to alarm sounds like it's more akin to, I agree it's not a mens rea, but calculated to alarm sounds to me like it's very similar to, hey, I'm doing this for a reason. I'm doing this for a particular purpose.
I agree completely, and maybe it's the fault of the legislature in putting in a mens rea and then putting in what is kind of like a mens rea, as in calculating. What I'm saying is you don't have to evaluate this case purely on what my client said, what my client testified to. The point is, when taking the evidence as a whole, which juries often do and are encouraged to do, they often believe A and B of one witness's version and C and D of another witness's version. And if they did that here, which they clearly could have done, because this was just a credibility case, then they could have found that my client, the defendant, did not intend to put the fear of serious bodily injury into the victims, but by displaying the weapon to them, it was calculated to alarm them. And yes, he did never specifically said, I calculated to alarm these victims. What I'm saying is that that's a rational reading of the evidence, and that the jury should have been allowed to come to that conclusion. And the court prevented them from coming to that conclusion by not giving them this lesser included offense. Now, in the Attorney General's brief, he cites primarily to Garcia, which is a case out of our Supreme Court from 1992, for the proposition that because we didn't completely admit that we calculated to alarm these victims, we shouldn't get the defense, or we shouldn't get the lesser included defense. But that's not what that case stands for. That's a case where the defendant did not get a heat of passion instruction because he admitted it, because the only evidence of heat of passion was a statement that he then said was a lie on the witness stand. That's entirely different from this case, and this case is much more akin to the Colorado Supreme Court case in Brown, 2010. And all they said there, the only test that there is you can get an inconsistent lesser included offense. I'm not even saying it's inconsistent. I'm saying it's entirely consistent with the evidence and with the defense up until the calculation part. But it said you can get an inconsistent lesser included offense to what your theory of defense is if there is simply a rational basis in the evidence for it. And in this case, I don't think anyone can dispute that there is a rational basis in the evidence if you take it in its totality.
Well, let me ask you about recklessly.
Yes, sir.
Recklessly is not in the felony menacing statute, is it? It's simply intentionally or knowingly?
It's just knowingly.
Knowingly. So on the lesser not included that you're advocating here, the person has to intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly. Now, you focused on not this wasn't knowing, this wasn't intentionally. What was it, recklessly? Because recklessly implies you recognize a risk and you proceed to do the conduct regardless of the risk.
I would say anytime you're fumbling around with a firearm at a high rate of speed on a public interstate, that's reckless conduct. And that's precisely what my client was doing here, and he does not deny that. He readily admits, I had my gun in a floorboard, I picked it up during this altercation, this high-speed chase, fumbled with it, and then put it in the glove box. I think a jury could very well find that that is reckless conduct. And so all the elements are here for disorderly conduct. We don't just have to take the victim's version of events. We don't just have to take the defendant's version of events. If you look at the totality of the evidence that was presented, every single element of disorderly conduct could have been satisfied, and the jury could very well, there was a rational basis for them to find my client guilty of disorderly conduct while acquitting him of menacing.
Mr. Huff, do you know of any case that extends Brown to lesser not included? As I read Brown, it's a lesser included case.
I don't think there's been any distinction made in the law. Of course, when we get lesser included, we feel a little bit more confident about our ability to get that. But in my reading of the law, I think the standard is exactly the same, if there's a rational basis. I just think it's easier to find the rational basis in a case of a lesser included because the prosecution charged the greater included. So they're basically stipulating in a lesser included case, that all the elements are there. In a lesser non-included case, they're not necessarily stipulating by their charging document that all the elements are there. There's no other questions.
I do have one more question. The Attorney General argues that this is harmless error because your client did get an instruction on harassment. Would you please respond to that?
Yes. I think if my client's conduct had been more applicable to harassment, then I would agree with that. However, the problem with the harassment statute as we submitted it and as we got it as a lesser non-included, it had nothing to do with a gun. It talks about repeatedly insulting, using offensive language. There are some elements that of harassment that were present here, but it certainly doesn't match up to the conduct that both sides' testimony showed. The jury didn't find him guilty of this lesser non-included of harassment. I would say I probably wouldn't have either, just based upon the fact that if a gun is involved, the jury's going to want to convict the defendant of some crime involving a gun. Now, it's great that the court gave us harassment. I'm sure we thought, hey, yeah, it's better. It's half a loaf is better than none at all. But what we really wanted, if you read the transcript, what we really wanted was disorderly conduct. And the reason we wanted that is because it matched up to the evidence very well, unlike harassment. If there are no other questions at this time, I'll save the rest of the time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, and may it please the court. John Lee, how people. Our number 38141. I'm going to apologize in advance. I'm kind of getting over a cold, so if my voice is hoarse and you can't understand me, please let me know and I'll try and say it clearer. As a general matter, it may be true that the truth lies between two stories, but in the context of lesser included instructions, our Supreme Court has imposed three express limitations. First, in order to get a lesser not included instruction, a defendant must show an evidentiary basis from which the jury could rationally acquit of the greater offense and convict of a lesser not included. Second, a defendant is not entitled to a lesser not included instruction if it's inconsistent with his sworn testimony. And third, a defendant is also not entitled to a lesser not included instruction if it's contrary to his theory of defense. The defendant's argument fails each of those three tests in this case. On the first, the question isn't, as the defendant puts it, whether or not the evidence as a whole could have allowed the jury to have somehow reached whether it supported the instruction. Our Supreme Court has made very clear, and this court did in Rubio, that rather what the test is whether the defendant can actually point to an evidentiary basis upon which the jury could have acquitted of the lesser but convicted of, or could have acquitted of the greater but convicted of the lesser. And the problem in this case is the evidence for both offenses came from the same fund of evidence. In this case, the defendant, under his own testimony, he committed no illegal conduct. He testified that he had no intent to ever threaten or harass or alarm the victims with his gun. He didn't even know that they had seen his gun. Now, according to the victims, the defendant pointed the gun at them and said, "Don't F with me." So, in this case, in order to find that either the defendant menaced or he acted in a way calculated to alarm, as required to find disorderly conduct, the jury would have had to look at the same evidence. There's not a sudden evidentiary basis for the jury to rationally have acquitted the defendant of the greater, but found him guilty of the lesser not included.
And Mr. Lee, why would the jury have to take one or the other? Why couldn't it take some of both? On the one hand, it could believe some aspects of the defendant's testimony. On the other, it could believe some aspects, but not all, of the victim's testimony, and thereby there would be a rational basis.
Well, Your Honor, in this case, we're dealing with one act and a lesser not included that almost has two mental states for the same act. So essentially what I'd be asking the jury to find is, we believe the defendant that he didn't intend to harm the victims, therefore he's not guilty of menacing, but we believe the victims that he intended to harm us, therefore he's guilty of disorderly conduct.
Well,
calculated to alarm.
Or we believe that the defendant acted in such a way that would put him in fear.
Yeah, and I think at least normally how the cases look at this. When it comes from this, if the jury were to believe that, they also would have believed, that means they would believe the victims, that's not a separate evidentiary basis for them to have acquitted the greater but not the lesser. Because it's more than a showing, and that's why we have the test. It's not just whether the jury could, evidence as a whole, have looked and found the defendant guilty of one offense or the other. So the defendant can actually show a separate evidentiary basis that would allow the jury to rationally acquit of one but find the lesser. Versus here, it would turn on the same amount of evidence. And because of that, it fails that test.
When you say the same fund of evidence, are you referring to the evidence as a whole or just to the defendant's testimony?
No, to the victim's testimony. Because based on the defendant's testimony, he couldn't have found guilty of anything. Under his testimony, he didn't commit a crime. So I'm saying in this case, the only way the jury could have found that the defendant intended to calculate harms if they would have believed the victims, which is the same evidence that would have caused them to have found he's also guilty of menacing. So there would only have been a rational basis to convict him of both or acquit him of both. There's not a rational basis to acquit him of menacing, but acquit him but convict him of the lesser included of disorderly conduct. Because it would depend on the same evidentiary basis, which again would violate the test.
But Mr. Lee, didn't the defendant testify that he, in reaching for the gun and putting it in his glove box, he held it in the air and he acknowledges that if someone saw that, it could have caused them alarm, even if that wasn't his intent? So wouldn't that be a basis to argue in closing that relates to disorderly case if you don't acquit him outright?
I don't think his testimony quite got there, at least as far as I read it. Nothing in his testimony could have been read to have inferred that he did anything with a gun in a manner calculated to alarm.
As I read the Torres case, calculated to alarm is the actus reus, though. It's not a mental requirement.
I read it as both. That it just, I mean, calculated, its plain meaning would be by design. So I don't, if it was just result, I think the lawyer would use the word like caused. I think given that they used calculated, that word, it was, they chose that word for a reason. And I think under any reasonable reading of calculated, I think even defense counsel submitted today that it would encompass some level of mental state. Because I don't think you can actually have the definition of calculated that wouldn't at least encompass some mens rea. But even assuming the defendant could meet the threshold showing that there is an evidentiary basis, he still would not be entitled to an instruction because it's inconsistent with his sworn testimony. As the Supreme Court made clear in Trujillo, a defendant is not allowed to seek a lesser not included if it's contrary to his sworn testimony. In that case, the U.S. Supreme Court explained that a defendant's sworn testimony is a judicial admission. Whether the statements be true or false, he's bound by them. Quote, and as a result, he will not be allowed to seek a judgment based on a jury verdict that he perjured himself. So when the defendant testifies to one thing, he's not allowed to seek an instruction on the lesser not included that holds the exact opposite. And in this case, the defendant testified that he absolutely did not act in any way intended to calculate it to alarm. So by providing under an instruction that was utterly inconsistent with his sworn testimony, it was properly refused.
Can you talk a little bit about Brown, though? Because as I read Brown, you are allowed to protest your innocence, but then seek a lesser included jury instruction.
Sure. I read Brown, as I think as you mentioned earlier, as applying only the lesser included. I mean, the Supreme Court made clear, if you look at it, that it was doing nothing to change its earlier cases regarding lesser not included. So you can theoretically present inconsistent defenses in the context of lesser included, but it has not been changed the law that says you cannot receive a lesser non-included instruction if it's against your sworn testimony. And I think there's some sense to that, although the Supreme Court didn't quite articulate it. I think it makes some sense in the context of lesser included because it's not really a theory of defenses in the lesser non-included, but it's the defense argument that people failed to meet its burden on the charge that it sought to prove. There's the context of lesser not included like we have here. It's a separate theory of the case. So it's a very kind of different and main principle behind it. So I see where there'd be a difference between lesser not included and lesser included. So the easy answer is just the Supreme Court made clear that there is a difference between the two and we treat them both differently.
And just switching topics, is the AG contending that the highway are you conceding it's a public place? Are you taking any position on it being a public place?
I'm taking any position. I mean, I guess in my mind, theoretically, it could be a public place. I thought, you know, just in this case, given the other arguments we had, that those are the better ones to pursue. For starting, it was not a public place. Third, the instruction is also properly refused because it was inconsistent with the defendant's theory of defense. In the Garcia case, it's completely clear that the defense cannot pursue a lesser not included if it's consistent with the theory of defense. The defendant's theory of defense in this case was that he committed no crimes at all. He didn't intend to scare anyone. The instruction that he intended, that he recklessly intended to alarm someone or calculate to alarm, inconsistent with his claim of absolute innocence.
Well, once again, that turns on your interpretation of Brown, that what's good for the lesser included is not good for the lesser not included.
Yeah, and I would say I'm fairly confident that I think Brown expressly acknowledges that the lesser not included cases still exist, and then explains that it's different in the context of lesser included because there's a statutory entitlement to lesser included. And then it goes through the separate analysis, explaining why. Finally, as explained in the answer brief, to the extent the defendant was entitled to it, any error was harmless, meaning that he was given a lesser not included of harassment. Essentially, the only way that the theory would work in this case was that the defendant should be convicted of something other than what he was charged with, that the jury might not find he was guilty of menacing, but maybe he was guilty of something, so therefore they should find him guilty of something. Given that the lesser not included were given in this case, harassment, the jury was given that option, they still found him guilty of menacing. So based on those verdicts, I think the record shows that any error was harmless.
But there's a significant difference between harassment and disorderly conduct. The jury could have found him guilty of disorderly conduct, but not guilty of harassment, and not guilty of the charge. Am I right? I mean, there's no similarity between harassment and disorderly conduct.
There's not necessarily similarity in the elements, but I would say there's similarity in the context of it being a theory, which again is all we're really talking about. We're dealing with lesser not included. Again, the defendant's theory in this case wasn't that he did something less, it was that he did nothing. So to the extent he got lesser included instructions in this case, the theory would have been, our theory is he did nothing, but theoretically did do something, convict him of something less than what they're charging him with. So to the extent that that was the alternative theory, that's covered by something less than what he was charged with, and he was given such instructions in this case. The court has no further questions. That is true, friend. Thank you.
Thank you.
I think Judge Dunn's point is very well taken. Let's be clear. My client denied that he threatened the victims. He denied that he knowingly placed or attempted to place them in fear of serious bodily injury. He did not sit up there and specifically deny that what happened could not alarm people. He did not sit up there and say, you know, I didn't display a deadly weapon. It wasn't in public. And they never said, no, it wasn't in a manner calculated to alarm. I think Judge Dunn's point is very correct. The way the defendant testified as to the facts, a reasonable, rational jury could find that by him displaying the gun, which he admitted to doing, and saying other people could have seen it in this public space, that could have caused alarm. Now, yes, is it slightly inconsistent? Perhaps. But the Brown case says that's fine. And I know Mr. Lee has cited sources that came before Brown that might have been a little muddy in that area. But if you read Brown, it's very clear. You can't have an inconsistent lesser not included with your absolute claim of innocence. Now, had we been given the option of arguing disorderly conduct, we probably would, and the closing argument probably would have gone something like this. He's not guilty of menacing because you heard him testify. He didn't intend to threaten anybody. However, we understand that this was very reckless conduct on behalf of the defendant, and maybe you don't want to find him guilty of what he's charged with menacing, but you could conceivably find that he acted in a way to calculate alarm, and that it was either knowingly or recklessly. And I think any rational jury that would have appealed to. I mean, it, particularly when you consider that, according to Mata Medina, when the court makes a decision whether or not to give a lesser non-included or lesser included, they must consider the evidence in light most favorable to the defendant. Now, that doesn't mean they must consider the defendant's testimony and the defendant's testimony only. It means what it sounds like it means, that in the totality, rational inferences that help the defendant should be given weight. And in this case, the court did not do that. In this case, the court only took the defendant's testimony and said, well, because he didn't admit to reckless conduct or he didn't admit to calculating alarm, I'm not going to give him this. Well, that's all well and good. But if you evaluate the evidence in the light most favorable to the defendant, and I'm talking the whole totality of the evidence, then disorderly conduct is a rational crime that the jury could have found that the defendant committed. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments this afternoon. This case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course. As soon as counsel can...